gathered here on Mother's Day with memories and with a restatement of our affections, regards, and admirations for our parents, especially the mothers who went through the mystery and the misery of bringing us forth. It seems, therefore, that it might be interesting to study one of the most curious circumstances in religion, and that is the relationship of the feminine principle to the principal basic theologies that have descended to us from antiquity. I think we may point out with some assurance that the purely masculine concept of deity is comparatively recent. In other words, most of the religions of antiquity had an entirely different attitude toward the invisible spiritual worlds and realities behind physical existence. Nearly all of the ancient religions of the world were more or less religions of family. In other words, the deities were more or less inspired by the earthly social structure, the brood family, the tribe. The emerging society was always the basis of a spiritual conviction. In other words, the earthly family, the basic family pattern, the Pythagorean 47th proposition, is father, mother, child. This was the original Trinity and has been so recognized for many thousands of years. In the mathematical formula of the Pythagorean equation, the square of 3 plus the square of 4 equals the square of 5. 3 father, 4 mother, 5 child. This concept has been sustained mathematically by philosophy for thousands of years. How then do we want to understand some of the points that have come up in the course of human change and evolution? Nearly all our religious thinking has been more or less rarefied to become the basis of our spiritual convictions. Society, more or less, regards itself as a symbolic unit, and this society has been extended upward to become the basis of a divine society. And the divine society of antiquity was merely a very rarefied version of human society. In the heavenly regions of the past, everything was based upon a family. It was not based upon a single deity. It was based upon gods and godlings and goddesses that were very human because they were based upon human archetypes. We find that the gods of antiquity had all kinds of problems. They had everything that we have on earth. They had the jealousies, they had the wars, the conflicts, the conspiracies that we associate with humankind. And these various problems became the basis of a concept of reality, a concept of reality in which the entire system of divinities was parental. The gods were the parents of mankind. These gods, to become parents, had to be parents. And each parent god, in one way or another, each deity, male and female, became parental as the fathers and mothers of mortals. The savior deities were the eldest sons of this parental family. The lesser divinities were some of them derived from subordinate religions. Some were merely an examination into the theory of relationships, uncles, aunts, brothers, sisters, children. But heaven was a family, and it was a family for thousands of years, and as such was almost completely dominant among the religions of the world. This family of deity, this father, mother, child, became heaven, earth, and the underworld. It became the great triad of will, wisdom, and action. It became another great triad of wisdom, love, and service. Everywhere things were triadic, and the deities involved had equal rights and privileges and received appropriate venerations. It is interesting to note, even now, that throughout the religious world, there are very few sanctuaries dedicated primarily to God the Father. We have the Son, we have the Holy Spirit, we have the saints of all denominations, but it is very rare, even in other religions, to find a sanctuary that is completely masculine, the exception principally being the Muslim faith. This idea of the parental pattern goes back to the brood family, the original primitive unit of human existence. The brood family goes back to the cave dwellers. It goes back as far as we can find a scratching on the wall of a cave. Everywhere, the brood family was the ruler. And in every brood family, the mother was the leader. Our American Indians have exactly the same concepts. It was the same concept in Central and South America. It was the same in Egypt. And in most of the religions of the ancient world, the brood family descended on the side of the mother. In Egypt, the mother was the one who named, designated, and served as the ruler of the ruler. In Egyptian philosophy, Isis and Osiris, brother and sister, were rulers of the other world, and brothers and sisters ruled the material world. Everywhere this rulership was divided, but not in a sense of conflict, but because it was a family. And unless there was the male and female principle, there could not be the progeny. And in ancient times, the progeny itself was humanity. Now, this kind of thinking in some way got out of line and has gradually disappeared in the popular worships of the modern world. It is, however, still to be found in a number of localities. One of the most interesting examples, of course, has been the descent of the concept of the solar deity. The sun god has usually been figured as male. But we still have one exception to that rule. About 60 or 65 million Shintos in Japan worship Amaterasu Omikame, the goddess of the sun. The sun is feminine in that religion. All over the world, the family pattern, however, has continued to influence the thinking of mankind. Here in society, we are struggling for a certain sense of equality to overcome prejudices and opinions. And if we go back to the ancient way of things, we will realize that the world as a family was governed by a hierarchy as a family. Now, this point is very clearly indicated in the writings of Confucius, the great Chinese sage. He explained that the human family, the parents and children, was the primary unit of human society. Everything came from that. In the material world, the individual family was the basis of the entire study of world populations, nations, races, and countries. After that, Confucius explained, first duty of mankind is to put the family in order. If the family is not in order, civilization will not endure. The family means compatibility, unity of effort, self-sacrifice if need arises, devotion, integrity, and loyalty. Unless these exist, the child will not become a superior person. The whole moral life of society is by example of the family. Children rule themselves because they follow the guidance of the family. When there is an emergency, the family stays together. And in ancient times, there was no inequality in the family. Each had their particular function each was entitled to equal respect, honor, and recognition. Confucius then pointed out that when the family is completely integrated, when the family has found complete loyalty, a loyalty, however, which is not exclusive, a loyalty which, however, governs the family inwardly towards its own roots, that when this has been achieved, then the community can be considered. The community is also a family. It is a family of families. The community must be put in order. If there are 50 families, these must work together, respect each other, regard each other, honor each other, and understand each other. If the community is considered a unit, and that unit is harmonious, then we come to the great city, which is made up of hundreds of families, thousands of them. But until the personal family and the community family have been rectified, the family of the great city cannot be rectified. There is no way of forcing upon the greater that which has not been bestowed upon the lesser. There is no way in which a great city can survive if the individual families have not been rectified. If the city is rectified, all of those working and living in it consider themselves as one family. This family may be made up of many levels, layers, and conditions, but it is still a unit. And it is a unit that must cooperate, must honor, must rectify relationships so that the community dwells in peace and honor, and various evils which are now rampant would no longer exist. From the great city comes the country, and the country is made up of many cities, and these cities are made up of many families, but the country is one. And unless all these lesser parts have been rectified, the country is in disorder. And if the country is in disorder, all the smaller units are troubled, as well as the progression of the country into the future. There can be no security in a nation unless its families, its homes, and its communities dwell together in honorable relationships. And if these honorable relationships are rectified, the nation or the country is well governed. And if the country is well governed, and each country likewise rectified, the world abides in peace, and all nations and all peoples are safe, and there can be no further strife, no ambitions to destroy, any more than a parent would want to destroy its own children. So after the world has been so rectified, there is one step further. And that one step further is to realize that this is an archetypal plan, a program that has existed before the beginning of time. And that above the rectified world is the region of the supreme family, that family which we call the Godhead, a family in which all virtues are exemplified, in which all rules and laws are imagined to exist. And in this divine family, there can be no prejudice, there can be no corruption of lesser peoples or plans, there can be no ambitions, only a great good family. But this great good family is invisible. And this great good family is beyond the estimation of the human mind in all of its patterns. Therefore, this great family is interpreted by human beings according to their own families. And if the families on earth are in friction and are dishonorable, then the gods in heaven are said to be suffering from conspiracies. If there are griefs and grievances among the gods, it is because man in his own image has created their likenesses and bestowed upon them his own frailties and limitations. But actually, in the concept as it is, Buddha summarized the statement by saying that creation itself is a great commune. It is a commonwealth. It is a tremendous diversity within unity. It is the supreme achievement of supreme divine insights. It has been placed here and developed, governed, and ruled by the highest conceivable systems of ethics. And the human being is not capable in all cases of fully appreciating this or accepting it or understanding it. But it still remains, as Confucius pointed out, the supreme law, the supreme plan, the supreme symbol, and the ordered universe is the symbol of the divine power. Now, this divine power must manifest in many ways. It manifests on earth, it manifests in the heavens, it manifests in the smallest insect, in the minerals, in the plants, in all creatures. There are laws regarding existence. And these laws are absolutely equal, fair to all concerned, with no prejudice and no preferences. All things measured by integrities alone. And these integrities are the innate truths that were planted therein by the divine power in the fashioning of all things. So in the beginning, we have a whole series of myths, great legends having to do with creation. And these legends are still very largely dominant in our thinking, even though we have transformed them into myths or symbols or emblems of power. The Egyptians, for example, had a series of triads. These triads were distributed through the nomes or provinces of Egypt. But in substance and essence, all of these groups of deities were a family. They were always father, mother, child. And in the most famous of these triads, which came in the middle and later dynasties of Egypt, the great triad was Osiris, Isis, and Horus. Horus was the beloved son, the symbol of enlightened humankind, and the intercessor. Also, Horus, as he grew up to manhood, became the defender of his parents. He guarded them. He took care of them. He interceded for the weaknesses of mankind. And before the throne of Osiris and Isis, the soul of the deceased was weighed to judge its virtues and its debilities. Isis was called the mother of mysteries. She was the leader of all the sacred arts. She was the leader of the initiation rites. She was the symbol, therefore, of the universal mother. The mysteries themselves. The temple was the symbol of the mother of mysteries. And all of those in Egypt who entered into the religions, and that involved practically the entire population, each one of them was the son of Isis. Each one regarded Isis as the great mother of mysteries. And she was the instructor, the informer, the savior, and the preserver. Most of all, she practiced the most supreme power in Egyptian philosophy, love. Because after all wisdom, after all strength, the great power of salvation lies in love. Love is what the parental family way up above regards as the proper instrument of relationship between the deities and their human creatures. And their animals, and their birds, and everything. So love was the great motion. Love was the great cohesive. Love was the basis of all morality, all growth, all security, all sanctity, and the protection of values. Therefore, they were all invested in Isis, the mother of mysteries. In the Phrygian rite, she was the Psychopompus, the mysterious being that was dressed in the raiment and in the ceremonial robes now associated with the Pontiff of Rome. The supreme power in Egypt then was Isis, and she became the symbol of all that was good and important. Her son became the savior of the world, and in the great rites at Sais, in the now lost and forgotten temple in Egypt, the initiations were in front of her altar. And in the final case of the example of perfect wisdom, the veil of Isis was raised, and the initiate saw the image face to face. Now, this was the way Egypt lived for thousands of years, because it was necessary and important that the graces of life should perfect the strength. Strength was important, but useless if not motivated by love. And love was useless unless it was in kinship and relationship with reason and wisdom. Therefore, in most of these philosophies, the god of wisdom and the goddess of mercy were the actual rulers of humanity. This brings us into another kind of relationship. In Greece, in the early days, there was no distinction, no peculiar emphasis upon the masculine as the symbol of all good. Zeus, or Jupiter, as he became in the Latin, was a kind of good-natured rascal, but not too much to be counted on. The great wisdom of Egypt was in Isis. The great wisdom of Greece was in the mysteries of Athena, Pallas Athena, the supreme power in Grecian culture. Athena was born from the head of Zeus. She was born by Vulcan, the god of fire, splitting the head of the supreme god and bringing forth Athena armed and helmed. She has therefore been referred to, rather facetiously, as the great headache of Zeus. But Athena was the mind. Athena was the intellect. Athena was the reason. And all of these were feminine attributes. Even wisdom, which was the keynote of Athena, was a completely feminine factor. Because true wisdom has to be built upon internal intuition. It has to arise from a communion between the individual and the divine power, a communion of love, service, and common understanding. Athena, therefore, armed, became the guardian of almost every important art and science. If it was necessary, by one reason or another, she became the defender of the faith. More likely, however, she was engaged in the arts. She was the goddess of schooling and education. She was the goddess of art and music and literature. She was the goddess of judgment and of law and of medicine. The great salvation of all things was entrusted to her because she was recognized as the actual manifestation of the divine power of Uranus and Cronus, the great gods of infinity. She was their product, born from them and of them, and everything that was good in nature was embodied in her by embodiment. So Athena not only became the guardian of many different arts and sciences, but she became the peculiar symbol of the International Bible Institute, and is found on practically all of the publications and writings of this group. She is also the Britannia of England, the Columbia of the United States. She is on the seal of the state of California, and she is found in all parts of the world as a mysterious sovereignty, a sovereignty of integrities and values. This goddess, therefore, became the Minerva of the Latins. And the Minerva of the Latins was given a particular instrument, a helmet. A helmet which, whenever she closed the visor of it, she became invisible. Therefore, she became the patron of secret societies and esoteric religions. It was always in her name. Zeus might be wandering about the earth on worldly affairs, but she was the guardian of the home, of life, of family, and of growth and integrity, nutrition, and internal wisdom, and of course of compassion. Now in the Orient we have a similar situation arise in connection with the esoteric teachings there. We find that Mahamaya, the mother of Buddha, holds a peculiar position in the Eastern thinking. She died 5 days after the child was born, and therefore does not play an important part in the general theology of Buddhism, only in certain respects. Actually, she became embodied in the symbol of the peacock, for the reason that the peacock was the devourer of serpents. And this was a very important symbol to the Eastern mind. And you will find that in a number of the symbols of the Immaculate Conception in European art, the Virgin stands with her foot upon a serpent's head. She is the overcomer of serpents or of evil. One of the most interesting symbols in Buddhism is, of course, that after Buddha's death, the body was placed in a magnificent wooden casket, the way in which it was usual to deposit bodies prior to cremation. And Mahamaya, the mother, came down from heaven to mourn for her son. And as she stood mourning for him, the casket opened and he rose from the dead to comfort her. And she joined him in the worlds beyond. So this is that legend, but it shows where the interest lies. Also in all Buddhism now, the Northern School, Kannon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is shown as feminine. Actually, she is represented as the mother again of all the good, all the wise, and all the noble. She is the one who brings the little lotus throne into the dying, to the dying Buddhist, and his soul is placed upon this lotus throne and carried to the other world. She is the intercessor for souls, the marvelous mother guardian of all orphans in any part of the world. Wherever a child is motherless, Kannon takes it for itself. These symbols go everywhere. Now, among the American Indians, we have some very interesting parallels to this. We find that in the Indian system, the brood family is the unit of culture and unit of civilization. Whether it be one of these tribes that wandered about in the plains and throughout the country, or those more permanently located in the pueblos of the Southwest, the brood family was always run in the same way. And the highest expression of it that we have has come down to us was the Great League of the Iroquois. The Iroquois League, or the first original and natural League of Nations, was the one that inspired Woodrow Wilson to attempt the creation of a League of Nations in the 20th century. But the Great League of the Nations of the Iroquois was a unit built for the glory of truth. And the building, the place where they met, was called the Long House. And the Long House was the one which was big enough to carry within it every living thing. It was the great house where all things lived in the one community relationship of family. Now, their various leagues had a political system that was so interesting that early in the development of it, sachems, or wise men from the Indian tribes, went to England at the request of the British government to explain their system of politics. And it was very, very simple. Each of the several tribes had its own senators, or congressmen, whatever you want to call them. They were the ones that became the representatives of the tribe. These congressmen or senators were elected, and the only members of the tribe that could elect them or vote was women. The men could not vote. They appointed the men, but they could not vote. Therefore, the sachems, as they were called, the senators, also then came to certain realizations and certain responsibilities which were unavoidable and inevitable and had to be completely obeyed and recognized. These sachems, each representing his tribe, had a limitation upon them. They could vote on any subject that did not relate to their own tribe. They could not vote for their own tribe. This was an interesting peculiarity that had rather long-range potentials. There could be no possibility, therefore, of them favoring their own tribe. They could not vote for it. If anything happened and the senator was unsuitable, the women recalled him and elected another one. But he had to pass through this type of election. In meeting, when the great tribe came together, the many tribes as one nation, the six nations, when they gathered together, they elected a chairman. And the chairman said at the point blank, "The door is open." The door being open meant that any subject or matter of importance could be discussed. All matters of importance had to be discussed in perfect calmness. No member of the group could say an unkind word about any other member. They had to say what they thought was necessary, but not attack anyone else in the saying of it. There could be no riots, there could be no arguments, there could be no filibusters. Each one presented his point, it was considered by the others, and as considered correctly, was passed, otherwise not passed. And then when the matter was concluded and the session came to an end, the chairman said, "The door is closed." And that was the end of the discussion. This is the way the Indians handled the matter. Today we have in the Pueblos some very interesting rules. And these rules include the voting and the living back and forth across the buildings. In most Pueblos there are two buildings, the men's house and the woman's house. Always they had to be marriage across the Pueblo, never within it. Members of one family could not intermarry. This was very, very ancient. And practically every one of these groups, the women were the prophetesses. They were the modern descendants of the Sibyls, the women of prophetic antiquity, of the Vestal Virgins, who were the guardians of the light of Rome. They were also the proprietors and leaders of the oracles, such as the Delphian Oracle. In every case, the communion with the gods was through women, not through the men. And the men got the message, but the women were the ones who went into the trances, who prayed, and who sat in the fumes of the oracle. So that it is a very interesting way of looking at a world problem, that in some mysterious way, the ancients seem to have been much wiser than we are in a great many matters. Also, I think it is well to bear in mind that in the early development of social society here, the human beings making up our social structure gradually became more or less separated from their religious principles. Now, the religious principles that we have today are identical with those of antiquity. They are the same truth, so which there can be no escape. But even now, with what we understand, or try to understand, we cannot keep the peace. We are unable to practice the principles and integrities that have descended to us. And we went from antiquity, with its very important equalities, with its tremendous emphasis upon intangibles, the victory of the invisible over the visible in every case, and the realization that the great truths flow down from causes unknown and unseen. We know these things, but we can't live them. Therefore, today we have a theology that is again based upon our sociology. We have a theology in which the ambitions take precedence over principles, wealth over integrity, and material power over spiritual values and life principles. So as just surely as the ancient world had its concept of the family, our modern world, more or less, has the concept of the family feud, we have inherited the complete feudal structure. And in order to prove that it was inevitable, we set up a war in heaven to make sure the same thing happened there. But we have no proof that this happened. We have only psychological convictions about it. The truth of the matter seems to be that we have merely shadowed our own shortcomings into space and made them seem to be divine laws. Actually, this is not the case. This is not real, but we have allowed it to become the common expression of our way of life. So in almost all parts of the world, we know that we dealt with a unified family divine power, that integrities were of several natures. There were integrities of the mind, integrities of the heart, and integrities of labor and common works. All these have to work together. And Comenius, the founder of the public school system, stated clearly and definitely that progress depended upon the education of the young, and that the education of the young, to have any value, must be acquired, built in, and perfected before the child goes to school. That leaves pretty much a key as to where it has to come from. The child has to learn from love and not from education as we know it. It has to experience principles, and it experiences them by living in the midst of them. This is why Confucius was so anxious to perfect the family, because with the family perfected, the generations go on one after another until the end of time. But with each family protecting the integrities of its young, society grows and perfects itself as a total. This is also clearly referred to by Mencius in his Doctrine of the Mean, and his tremendous respect for his own mother and the disciplines which his mother gave him. So everywhere we have this ancient recognition that there has to be a unit in society that works together, and that this unit has no superiorities and no inferiorities. It merely represents the manifestations of the principal processes of divine existence. In ancient times, there was very little of what we know as today as class consciousness. And even now, we realize as we go backward culturally, and we can do this in our present generation, as we drop back into the earlier centuries in the presence of emerging countries and those that have not emerged, we realize that the further back we go, even in modern society, the more equality there is. Inequality is a modern fashion. It is something that has come up when the individual felt that he could afford to disregard a large part of his own structure. But back in the older and lower areas of culture, men, women, and children worked together on equal terms, each doing what is necessary to the preservation of society. Gradually, we have changed this pattern. But as we have changed it, things have become consistently worse. We are not advancing the way we should. I think the time is very much at hand when we will have to realize that God is not a bachelor, that he is not something all by himself, that God represents a symbol, and that divine symbol is actually what we call in Christianity a Trinity. It is three in one, one in three. And deity as a Trinity is father, mother, child, a basic principle. It is the creator, the preserver, and the redeemer. It is the actual family itself, with wisdom, love, and labor united in an absolutely indissolvable unity. If we can begin to think this type of thing, it will do a great deal to help to release the individual from a condition that has gradually intensified in recent centuries, a condition unknown to antiquity.
a condition that had no place in the original plan of things, but which has gradually come to have a dominant value in social problems, largely from ambition and economic factors. So here today, we're more or less here to pay honor to what is probably the world's most important single symbol, and that symbol is maternity. It is the symbol of that without which all things end, that which, if disregarded or perverted, destroys civilization. The fate of the world and the future of humanity, whether we realize it or not, is essentially in the keeping of women. Men can help them. Men can take from them certain labors that are difficult. But the ideals and principles of progress are feminine, and as such, must be allowed to mature and develop, and the women themselves must recognize the divine birthright which they have, respect it, honor it, and live up to it. Because in this they have a uniqueness that nature has ordained, and for which the individual himself can no longer be held directly responsible, but for which all beings must labor together. Today we are in the presence of a great tragedy of conflict and difficulty and militarism. We are in the presence of every type of antagonism. We are in the presence of a situation in which, unless something comes along to change the general poise of things, the whole structure of civilization is endangered. The future of our children is endangered. And all the privileges which we have earned with pain and sorrow will be taken away. So we have to consider very definitely the problem of protecting the great basic triad of laws upon which we live. And there's no way of breaking these laws. There's no way of evading the responsibility. And remember that in the Platonic dialogues that we have the Plato in his older years, after he had more or less retired from public life, teaching a few of his better disciples, including his nephew Speusippus, that all wisdom has as its end only one thing. Wisdom helps us to love and keep the faith. There is nothing in wisdom that can save us, but it can make us aware of something superior to itself. Education is not going to save us, no matter how many universities we build.